All right, let's finish STDs. I think we were on starting syphilis. Okay, caused by the agent Treponema pallidum. What kind of organism is that?
Spirochete,
bacteria, spirochete, okay. And we are seeing an increased number of syphilis cases. So this is one of the three classical STDs that's been around for centuries. Still here, still going on.
Benjamin Franklin
had it?
That's syphilis, yeah, for sure.
I don't remember that. That could be.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, that's right. He also
had
spinal
stones.
Yeah, he did. He also had
kidney stones.
He also had kidney stones. Okay, this organism can penetrate intact mucosal surfaces. We've said before that most organisms can't do that. They need some kind of abrasion to get into it. But it can penetrate intact skin as well as get through abrasions. This one has three different phases or stages of disease. The primary disease is the first occurrence, and that occurs anywhere from 10 to 90 days after infection symptoms develop. Symptoms in the primary stage are described as a hard chancre. So they're lesions, ulcerative lesions, hard chancre. What did we say was a soft chancre? Anybody remember?
Anthrax.
Soft. Oh, yeah, from the STDs. STDs, yeah. Chancroid. Okay. Okay, so this one's a hard chancre. The lesions begin as erythematous macule developing the papule and ulcers, and they're described as circular, smooth, clean base, edges sharply defined, so it's a little bit different from the soft chancre. But down here, it says absence of pain. So apparently they're not really painful. I fail to understand that, but... bilateral lymphadenopathy, so lymph nodes are swollen. Now, one way we can diagnose this, because we can't grow this on laboratory media, it doesn't grow on routine media. So especially in clinics, sexually transmitted disease clinics, STD clinics, the docs will probably have available a dark field microscope, because it's very easy to get some of the lesion material that weeps or leaks out from the lesion, and put that on a slide, look at it under a dark field microscope, or direct fluorescent antibody, and you look for the spirochetes. This is a direct fluorescent antibody stain, so you can easily see the spirochetes in there. This is the type of lesion, the hard chancre. Okay, then the primary stage will resolve without treatment. Obviously, it's best to treat it, but it will resolve without treatment. However, it can progress into the secondary and tertiary stages. It doesn't have to, but we'll see here in a minute a slide that shows the progression of the disease. So secondary symptoms develop anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks after the appearance of the first or the primary stage. This is more of a generalized spread, so you see it throughout the body, and it has some systemic symptoms associated with it. Skin rash, fever, myalgia, lymphadenopathy. This is kind of what the skin rash looks like in secondary syphilis. So this is a papular rash. It can have these kind of scaly patches on them.
Just look like zits to me.
Yeah, they might. And then the tertiary stage. So the secondary stage can also resolve without treatment, or it can progress to the tertiary. Okay, so tertiary stage is characterized by degenerative and destructive changes, which are referred to as gumas. So a guma is a nodular, or in some cases, ulcerative lesion. You can see the gumas developing here. And then, if a patient does progress into tertiary, which takes years, this is usually years after a primary and secondary, the main problems are that it affects the heart, so cardiovascular disease, and the neurosyphilis, so it affects the brain and people can experience the insanity of tertiary syphilis, also known as tabes dorsalis, which is characterized by muscular incoordination and that kind of thing. Okay, one of the other problems with syphilis is that it can have complications associated with it passed on to the fetus or the neonate. So congenital syphilis, transmitted by the placenta, and all of these characterizations. So they don't have to have all of them, but they can have one or more. It can be more serious. Some are more serious than others. Skin lesions, meningitis, mentally retarded, blindness, deafness. You know, all of these things can be passed on to the infant as they pass through the birth canal from an infected mother, or in some cases, transmitted by the placenta. Malformed jaw and nose, which is called saddle nose, and then Hutchinson's incisors are characteristic. So this is what the saddle nose looks like. The bridge of the nose is indented or concave, and then these are Hutchinson's incisors where you have the notched teeth.
So this is the son?
This is an offspring of an infected mother. Right.
So how does it
I don't know how it results in these types of deformities. I don't know exactly what the mechanism is, but those are some characteristics. Let me back up here. So the malformed jaw, nose, Hutchinson's incisors, and those can be associated with any of these others, or maybe not, maybe just this. So it can have one or more of these symptoms, congenital symptoms. Okay, let's talk about the testing for syphilis, what we do in the laboratory. STS is an abbreviation for serological tests for syphilis. So we've got the STDs, we've got the STSs. What's SPS?
Sodium.
All right, that's what we used last week, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. There's two types of procedures that we can use to test for syphilis. One of these is called the nonspecific, and the other is the specific. Let's go through the nonspecific first. These are also called the reagent tests. The antibody is a nonspecific antibody or a reagent antibody. This is used mostly for screening. They used to do BDRLs, which stands for Venereal Disease Research Laboratory. And in some cases, they still do it. It's mostly done on spinal fluids. And that would be in the event that the patient has tertiary syphilis, where it has affected the brain. But it's a very tedious and time-consuming procedure. The reagents have to be made up fresh every time it's done. They have to be heated. There's just all kinds of things that they have to go through. So that one's not really used much anymore for routine screening. What we use instead is the RPR. Anybody know what RPR stands for? Yeah. Anybody ever done RPRs? You all did. All of those that you had 102, at least. We did RPRs in 102. Do you not remember?
No.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I figured as much. So we are going to do these next week. We're going to refresh your memories and do the RPRs. Because they are common, it is a common screening test for syphilis. In fact, they used to do it to screen blood bank meals before donation. Is that right, Professor?
Well, they still do syphilis testing.
On all of them?
On every donor, yeah.
Oh, okay. So they still do them on every donor. So are you going to do them in the lab?
What is it?
Okay, so we'll do them. We'll do them then. Okay, what the RPR test is, it's on a little card, plastic card, coated card. We put it on a rotator and rotate it. Remember that? Okay, you will. The reason it's called nonspecific is because we are not testing for antibody to the treponeme. So what happens is, well, we use an antigen. It's called cardiolipin. This is lipid from beef heart. Cardiolipin is an antigen. It's antigen plus probably phospholipid from beef heart is the antigen. And the antibody we look for is antibody against lipid released from damaged cells. So as the treponeme invades the cells, It upsets the cell membrane, releases these phospholipids, which are going to react then with the cardiolipids. So that's why it's called nonspecific. We can get some cross-reactivity, particularly with people that have autoimmune diseases, can get a positive RPR. And even as we age, the elderly, 90 plus, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Rapid plasma reagent.
Rapid plasma reagent. Oh, did I not say that? I asked you a question, nobody answered it. Rapid plasma reagent is what it stands for. So you can get some false positives with this one, but that's why it's just a screening test. If it's positive, then they will go on probably to do some additional tests to determine if the patient actually has syphilis or if it's a false positive. The specific treponemal antibody test then, it's called specific because they actually test for antibody to the treponeme. There's three different types. The one that's used most commonly is this immunofluorescence fluorescent treponemal antibody absorption test. And I'm not going to go through the principles of all of these tests. You just need to recognize that those are specific treponemal antibody tests. Different laboratories will do different ones depending upon what they want to use, but the FTA absorption is probably the most common. The disease is still responsive to penicillin. That's probably the drug of choice, but of course there are many others that can be used. But the point is it can be treated and should be treated so that it doesn't progress to the secondary and tertiary stages. Okay, this is the RPR test. We take this plastic card. It's got five circles on it. We can do controls with it. What we're looking for is agglutination. It's actually kind of flocculation test, but we refer to these as reactive or non-reactive instead of positive or negative. Reactive or non-reactive. So if the antibody is there, and again, this is RPR, so we're detecting the phospholipid antibody, we have charcoal particles that are added to the antigen, and that's why it looks very dark. So that's the name, to enable you to visualize it better, more clearly, the charcoal particles. But the particles will be distributed over the whole circle as to the type of agglutination. If it's reactive, if it's non-reactive, the charcoal particles will tend to stay together in a circle. And then what I like to do, or tell students to do, is to take the card and just kind of swirl it a little bit, and you often see a little tail. You can kind of see it a little bit right here. You see a tail of the charcoal particles coming out from the clump. But that's how you differentiate non-reactive versus reactive. Now, some of them are weakly reactive. Sometimes they'll do dilutions. So in some cases, it's a little bit difficult to tell if it's negative, non-reactive, or reactive. But we'll do these not next week, but I think the week after. Okay. Now, as far as sensitivities of the test, these are the non-treponemal, the non-specific tests. These are the specific tests. And this tells you the stage of the disease, primary, secondary, and tertiary. Okay, primary, you can see the sensitivity isn't 100% or 90%. It's right around 70 to 80% in there. These two are not very good for screening. But the specific ones really aren't any better than the non-specific ones for screening, so that's why we use RPR. In the tertiary stage, every one of them are highly sensitive for syphilis. But look over here in the late stage. If it's progressed to tertiary, the screening tests aren't any good at all. They're worthless. But the specific ones are still highly sensitive for the detection of the treponeme. So we kind of use the test. We use the non-specific for screening, and then we use the specific ones for in later stages.
Why is it so such a good screening during the second stage?
I don't know, other than it's systemic. The symptoms, the organism might be present in different tissues and the blood. I don't know specifically. Okay, this is the course of the disease that just show you that it can resolve without treatment or it can progress. So here's the incubation period. Time of infection, incubation period, 10 to 90 days for primary syphilis. And then the primary symptoms can occur. Now, they can resolve without treatment. So let's follow this line. If they resolve, this line can go over here years later and spontaneous cure. So they don't have to progress to secondary or tertiary. can cure. It can be cured in some cases. Other cases, it will progress into secondary. And they'll get the symptoms, and they might have recurrences of the symptoms. But again, if we follow the line, it can resolve itself without treatment. Secondary. Okay? Years later, this is usually like 15, 20 years or more later, if it progresses, it goes into the tertiary stage. So here's where we get cardiac problems, aneurysm, aortitis, that's cardiac, and the tapes dorsalis, the neurosyphilis, neurological, where they can actually go insane. Neurosyphilis can lead to insanity. It leads to motoring coordination. Patients often, when they walk, their foot kind of slaps down. And sometimes you hear the disease, the slang term is the clap. And that's because of the way they walk, their incoordination. So that's what can happen. Anything can happen. It can resolve or it can progress. So it's best to get it treated, because if it is treated, then it's not going to progress. Okay, let's go on to others. Cervicitis and urethritis. Speak.
You were saying that I was treating penicillin, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't there a good chance that they'd be treated with penicillin and some point they'd treat them 20 years later?
It's oftentimes more difficult to treat it once it progresses to that stage. Secondary, you can probably still treat. Tertiary, once it's progressed to that stage, it's not treatable. Because the damage has already been done.
Right,
but
you know
how
there's that long line there? Right there.
In here?
Right here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But they're not going to have any symptoms in here, so...
But could they have a symptom of something else, get treated for penicillin, and it knocks this guy out too?
I can't say for sure. I would probably say no, because I would think it would be very common for them to get some kind of treatment for other things during that period of time.
That's what I was thinking.
But it doesn't... They can still progress, so I would say no. Okay, cervicitis and urethritis. Now remember, we kind of classify these to some extent based on the types of symptoms that are involved. So this is a urethritis, but it's called a non-gonococcal urethritis, because if you remember, we're talking about gonorrhea. That was a urethritis, and so that's gonococcal urethritis. This is non-gonococcal urethritis. But it can affect cervix and the urethra. Okay, chlamydia trachomatis. This is considered the most common bacterial STD in the U.S. Bacterial STD. So we just usually refer to it as chlamydia. There are different strains, different serovars, so it's probably not the same strain that causes trachoma, the blindness that we talked about earlier. Symptoms: acute urethral syndrome. Which means they can present with a urinary tract infection or symptoms of a urinary tract infection. So we have sterile pyuria. What do you think sterile pyuria is? What does pyuria mean?
White blood cells.
White blood cells. Okay, so we've got white blood cells, but no organisms. That's what sterile pyuria means. White blood cells, but no organisms are seen. Mucopurulent discharge, dysuria, painful urination, so it can present that way as a urinary tract infection. The way we diagnose it is with cervical or urethral swab, so depending upon whether it's male or female, and or a cytobrush. We talked about the cytobrush, which is inserted, and we rotate that. It's got a little brush on it, so what that does is collect the cells. Because chlamydia, we cannot grow on routine media, so it grows inside cells. So we need the cells in order to see the organism. And we need to do tissue culture if we want to culture it.
Just a quick clarification. So if chlamydia bacteria is actually in there, why wouldn't you find it like around the sterile? When you got to examine the sterile pyuria?
Well, because it's usually intracellular. So you can't see it initially. We can also do serological testing using enzyme immunoassays for the antigen. So those are the best ways, serological or tissue culture. Okay, this is the type of discharge that comes from the urethritis. So it's more of a clear, watery discharge. then is what we saw from gonococcal urethritis. But again, oftentimes it's difficult to determine immediately what's going on here. Okay.
I just have a quick question. I have a brother-in-law who worked in Vegas as a medical doctor, and he said a lot of times people with STDs will have eye infections with STD, like chlamydia or whatever. Is that another good way of diagnosing?
Well, it's probably a clue. Herpes, you could have eye infections. So you can't, just because of the eye infection, you can't tell for sure whether it's chlamydia or something else. But it's probably helpful in ruling out certain things.
Is there any particular reason why it would affect the eye?
Well, and gonorrhea will do that too. And one reason is because it just gets disseminated in the body, and it can spread to other sites. Or it can come from contamination on the hands, rubbing the eye.
That's true.
So the good reason to wash your hands.
Why did you have to
ask? Sorry.
Okay. This one is associated, chlamydia is associated with complications. And again, primarily the complications occur in females or transmitted to the fetus. PID, what's PID? Pelvic inflammatory disease, so it's a lower abdominal disorder. One attack, PID, a patient has 25% chance of sterility, three attacks, 75% chance, eight times greater chance of ectopic pregnancy with PID. Okay, what's esophagitis?
Infection of the
fallopian tubes. Okay, and those can get scarred, which means that it could increase chances of ectopic pregnancy or just sterility itself because the ovum can't get through the fallopian tube. So there's infertility, and it can be transmitted to infants and birth with a variety of symptoms that occur. This one, I just put antibiotics here because it's treatable. The main thing is it's treatable. If it's diagnosed soon enough, it can be treated. Okay, bacterial vaginosis. It used to be called nonspecific vaginitis. Now, what's the difference between a vaginosis and a vaginitis? What does the suffix osis mean?
Infection.
A condition of. What does the suffix itis mean? Okay, so they used to call it nonspecific vaginitis, NSV. But they changed it to vaginosis because it is not an inflammation, not an inflammatory condition. So that was really an improper term. But vaginosis just means it's a condition of the vaginal tract. It occurs primarily in females, but males can contract it. Okay, causative agent, primarily Gardnerella vaginalis, which is what we're dealing with now, tiny gram-negative variable rods. Have you seen these on Gram-Stain? Be able to grab, save, and look at them? What do they look like? Tiny? Gram negative?
Yeah.
Okay, they're called gram variable at times because they have a much thinner peptidoglycan layer on the cell wall. And so they can decolorize more readily or they can accept, keep the stain or whatever. So sometimes you can see both gram negative and gram positive in there. But they are gram negative rods. There's another organism called Mobiluncus that we can see in there, which is a curved gram-positive rod, or sometimes gram-variable. It's an anaerobe as well, and there can be some other anaerobes. Okay, now what do we say about Gardnerella on Monday as far as normal flora? Is it normal flora?
It can be.
What percentage? About 50% of patients can have Gardnerella as normal flora. So, if we culture it, does that mean it's normal flora or a pathogen? Okay, probably on the number. So basically, an increased number of Gardnerella. What else is normal flora? What was it? 68% normal flora. The other known that we're doing this week.
Lactobacillus.
Okay. So what we're going to see is a disruption of normal vaginal flora. That's primarily how we diagnose it. Not just from culture, because the culture doesn't really tell us a whole lot. So we're going to see an increase in the number of Gardnerella and a decrease in the Lactobacillus. Now, how do we... This is what Gardnerella looks like. These tiny, tiny rods. Symptoms, vaginal discharge with accompanying odor. What's pruritus?
Itching.
Pruritus is an itching. Vaginal irritation, which can result in itching. It's kind of an irritation of the nerve endings that causes the itching or the irritation. It says here no soreness. I would think if you've got vaginal irritation, you've probably got some soreness, but not. It's not tremendous soreness, I guess, like some of the others that can be very painful. Particularly herpes can be very, very painful. Okay, males are usually asymptomatic. They can contract the Gardnerella, but they usually don't have symptoms. Okay, so what do we do in the laboratory then? We have to diagnose this a little bit differently. So culture, we're gonna culture it, but that really doesn't tell us a whole lot. So we do this scoring method. We do Gram stain of vaginal fluids. And we're going to look for a disruption of the normal flora. We're going to look for a decrease, large gram-positive rods. These would be the lactobacillus. And we're going to look for an increase in the tiny gram-variable, gram-negative rods, which are the Gardnerella, or the curved rods, which are the Mobilungus. So, here's the way we score it. Scores for the number of each morphotype per oil immersion field. If we see greater than 30 of lactobacillus, we give that a score of 0, because that's normal. Let me put this up here. Okay, the green circles represent normal situation. So over here, normal is 0 to 3. We add up our scores. 0 to 3 is normal, intermediate is 4 to 6, and bacterial vaginosis is 7 to 10. Okay, so a normal situation then would be a lot of lactobacillus. So we're going to give that a 0 or maybe a 1. Tiny gram variable rods, 5 to 30, somewhere in there usually. We'll give that a score of 3. And we're not going to see any Mobilungus. So we're going to give that a score of 0. So we add those all up. We get usually somewhere between 0 and 3 is normal. 4 to 6, it's questionable. But then, this is abnormal. We get into the red circles are an abnormal. So, we don't see any gram-positive rods. The lactobacilli are gone. So we can have a 4 or a 3 there or something. But we do see an increase in the number of Gardnerella, greater than 30, so we give that a score of 4. We do see some Mobilungus, we give that a score of 2. So we add those up, and what have we got? 4, 4, 2.
10.
So anywhere between 7 and 10 would tell us that we're most likely dealing with a case of bacterial vaginosis. Okay, does everybody understand how we got these numbers? How we scored them? Okay, so that's more helpful than just culturing the organism.
Do we add up like 4 plus 2?
You're going to add, well, the green circles are normal, okay? This is what we see in a normal situation. So we're going to see a lot of lactobacilli. We're going to see some Gardnerella, because that's normal. We shouldn't see any Mobilungus, so we add up all of the circles.
So for the red circle, do we add
up? For the red ones, we add up all the red circles. So we're going to score what we see for lactobacillus. You'll see a lot of those. That has a score of 0. Or I mean, I'm sorry, I said that wrong. We're not going to see any lactobacillus or a decreased number. So that has a higher score because it's a decreased number, which is abnormal. These have an increased number, which is abnormal. So they have a higher score. So we add up the 4, 4, 2, which gives us a 10. So somewhere between 7 and 10 is indicative of this disruption in the normal flora.
Okay, so it says per oil immersion field, how many fields do you do? Or do you just do one?
No, we're going to look around and probably get an average. You have to look at one, just one.
Right.
Yeah, so you're probably taking an average.
What's the point of culturing?
Well, because you've got the organism. If you decide the patient's got bacterial vaginosis, you've got the organism there, and you can do further testing on it. to identify it specifically as Gardnerella. So what kind of test do we do for Gardnerella? What did you do? Catalase? Oxidase? SPS disc. Okay, so we don't have to do much with it. It's basically seeing how it grows, looking at it, working under the microscope, and identifying it that way along with the clinical symptoms. Okay, and I don't know if I mentioned, well, it says on your flow diagram, I think, there is an auger called bee auger that we don't use much. Some labs might use it. Well, some clinics might use it more. A bee auger has human blood in it rather than sheep red blood cells. And with human blood, Gardnerella is beta hemolytic, but it is not beta hemolytic on regular sheep blood auger. Okay, so summarizing then, the culture is nonspecific. The symptoms include a watery vaginal discharge, non-inflammatory, so you don't see white cells. That's why it's not vaginitis, it's a vaginosis. We do a test called a whiff test.
Oh, it's not.
Yeah, we do. You do. You do. It has an abnormal fishy odor with addition of potassium hydroxide. Potassium hydroxide reacts with amines that have been produced from bacterial metabolism. You get this fishy odor. There's a whiff test. Now, is that worse than the fecal samples or sputum samples?
Up by your nose,
no.
Yes.
Okay, that's the whiff test. And we look for presence of clue cells. We mentioned clue cells yesterday, but we didn't say what they are. Clue cells are squamous epithelial cells that are coated with bacteria. The bacteria usually adhere to the outer edges of the squamous epithelial cell. So we can do a wet mount, which would be just taking some of the watery discharge, maybe putting it with a little saline, spreading on a slide, slapping a cover slip on it, and just looking at it without stain. So you can see the bacteria adhere to the edges. Gram stain is going to show the gram-negative, gram-variable rods in here. So those are called clue cells. Now, we typically see those only in bacterial vaginosis. So those are helpful tests as well. This one can be treated. Antibiotics. Who knows what metronidazole is? Yeah. Metronidazole is the generic term for flagyl. Flagyl is the trade name. It's usually used to treat parasites. Protozoa parasites. But it is effective against Gardnerella in bacterial vaginosis. This one can have complications. So in some rare cases, and those are not as common as complications in other STDs, but it can happen. Okay, now, one other thing about bacterial vaginosis is it does not have to be a sexually transmitted disease. Okay, that's one way it's transmitted. But there are also some other predisposing factors by which particularly females can have this disruption in the normal flora that leads to increased numbers of Gardnerella, decreased lactobacillus, and the symptoms. States of estrogen stimulation. So sometimes, I presume, depending upon the time of the month or whatever, if there's more estrogen, it can lead to increased growth of some of the epithelial cells, which can, and I don't know the exact mechanism, but disrupt the normal flora somehow. And of course, that doesn't happen every month or in every female. Metabolic factors would be things like something that disrupts the vaginal environment, normal flora, maybe antibiotic usage that's going to depress the normal flora and allow some of the Gardnerella to increase. Local factors, intrauterine devices used for birth control might upset the vaginal flora. Mechanical factors, things like tight clothing. There's our old hot tub again. Another reason not to go hot tubbing. Sweating, those kinds of things. So people can get it in other ways other than being sexually transmitted. Okay, everybody wait. No, they're not that big yet.
How big are they?
They look like a little mouse.
Little
tiny.
Are
your
eyes open?
Your eyes are not open yet, no.
When does that happen?
I think that happens about 10 days. Somewhere between a week and 2 weeks. So they were born, Saturday night? So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. They're almost 4 days old.
You have to bring one in.
Okay, everybody awake. All right, then we go on to Trichomonas. Trichomoniasis also is known as is a vaginitis. Okay, what kind of organism is Trichomonas?
Parasite,
protozoan. Okay, good. Symptoms, copious, malodorous, frothy, or bubbly yellow-green. Try to color code that. Vaginal discharge. There it is. Frothy, bubbly, yellow-green. Okay? Which is different, a little bit different from the vaginal discharge we've seen from other ones. Okay. This is the organism, protozoa. It's a pear-shaped organism. It has a flagella. And you can see this, if a person has trichomonas, you can see it in just a routine urine sample when you're doing a urinalysis, microscopic urinalysis. Yes, you can see that without the stain.
They approximate the size of a white cell, so when you're looking at a UA and all of a sudden your white cells start swimming.
that happens. So you kind of have to look carefully for it, because sometimes you don't see the flagella. Sometimes it might be a little rounder, and it's not going to be purple if it's not stained, so it will look like a white blood cell in some cases, and then you'll see it twitch or move, so you have to look carefully and make sure you don't miss it. Numerous white thrush-like patches. Oh, I'm sorry. We're back up. I went the wrong way. Okay, pruritus, itching associated with it. We can diagnose this by a wet mount. Okay, so we could do a routine urinalysis and sometimes see it. That's not real sensitive, though. You don't always see it. Wet mount would just be taking some of the frothy, bubbly green, yellow-green discharge, whatever it's called, put it on slide, maybe mix it with some saline, cover slip, and looking at it that way. But that doesn't have great sensitivity either. This one can be cultured in a special broth for trichomonas. And it's oftentimes treated with metronidazole. Again, that's useful for the parasites and the protozoans. Trichomonas, again, does not have to be a sexually transmitted disease. It can be picked up in other ways. Okay, let's move on to candidiasis. What kind of organism is Candida albicans?
Yeast.
Okay. This is also vaginitis. But the symptoms are a little bit different. Vulvar skin and mucosa are intensely pruritic, itchy, and what's erythematous? Reddened area. Okay. This is what characterizes, we often call a Candida infection thrush. We'll talk about this when we get into mycology, which we're starting next Monday, right? Okay, thrush-like patches cover vaginal mucosa. These are cream-colored to pale yellow, thick, curdy discharge. Okay.
Oh, wow.
You know how a lot of babies get thrush? It's not from this at all.
Okay. Thrush does not have to be sexually transmitted. And you can get the vaginal thrush, you can get oral thrush around the oral cavity. And that's what babies often get. We'll talk about that more next week. So it does not have to be sexually transmitted. We diagnose it by doing the Gram stain and the culture. And this is what we're going to do next week. So I'm not going to go into Saburo's auger and the starry edges and all that kind of stuff. It does grow in blood. This is what Saburo's auger looks like. It's a clear color auger, and they grow as cream colored colonies, look very much like bacteria, but grow in blood also look very much like bacteria. But we do Gram stain. Do these look like bacteria? They're larger. They're much larger than bacteria. They're often oval shaped, and what you specifically look for are these little buds. That's how the organism reproduces. It makes a copy of its DNA. Forms this little bud on the side, pushes the DNA on there, and eventually this bud detaches from the parent cell and forms a new cell. So, and they're always gram positive because yeasts have a cell wall. Fungi have a cell wall, so they're going to retain the gram stain. Okay, let's go on to herpes simplex. This is virus, of course, causes genital ulcers. There's the herpes simplex type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is usually what causes cold sores. They often use that distinction. Type 1 is above the belt. Type 2 is below the belt. But you can still get an intermixing of those. Very common. We said, what did we say was the most common bacterial STD? Chlamydia. Okay. This is probably the most common viral. This is a virus, so we can't link it in the same statistics as chlamydia, but herpes is very common. Well, it's estimated about 10% of the population is infected with herpes. Virus penetrates the mucosal surface and replicates inside the epithelial cells. So no, the viruses are intracellular organisms. They get inside cells, replicate, and then herpes, the family of viruses that belong to herpes, can enter the peripheral nerves, and there they remain for the life of the individual. Usually they go dormant, and occasionally they'll pop out, cause a cold sore, or in the case of herpes type 2, cause these genital ulcers. But there is no cure. The virus, there is no cure. Once you've got herpes, you've got herpes. There are medications you can take to lessen the severity of the outbreaks and to minimize to some extent the transmission. But there is no cure. Okay, now, primary is the first time we experience the disease. 50% of people are asymptomatic. They don't have symptoms. And so for that reason, it's difficult to diagnose. They don't know they have it. It's easy to transmit it to a sexual partner because they don't take precautions. They don't know they have it. There's a 1 to 2 day prodrome. What's prodrome?
Incubation.
It's not incubation. Incubation is no symptoms. Prodrome are sometimes the symptoms that occur before the outbreak of the lesions. So, could have malaise, fever, headache, but again, not all of them have it. Enlarging painful clusters of small vesicular lesions on erythematous bases. Wow. Okay. And associated with that, just swollen lymph nodes in the inguinal area. Itching, urethrovaginal discharge, there can be a lot of symptoms associated with it. Okay, this is what the ulcers look like, or the vesicles for the virus. Erythematous basis, so it's redness, red basis here with these ulcers. This is a larger one, they can be smaller than that. So when the outbreak is present, obviously there's virus in there and the patient is infected, but they can still shed the organism without the ulcers. The outbreak. So that's why it's not a good disease to contract. Okay, once you have the primary outbreak, then patients will have recurrent outbreaks. And these can occur every few weeks or maybe every couple of months, or it just kind of depends on the person. It's an individual type thing. But each outbreak is milder and shorter than the primary infection. And the systemic symptoms are uncommon in the outbreak, so you don't have the fever, the malaise, and that kind of thing goes along with it. You might have a little itching or tingling sensation first, and then the outbreak of the lesions. But, as indicated here, the virus can be shed without the lesions. Okay, this one can also be congenital, passed on to the infant. Encephalitis, eye infections, high mortality rate. If the mother obviously has a known case of this, they'll take the baby C-section to prevent transmission. Okay, the way we diagnose it is, because this is a virus, we can't culture it on routine media. We have to do the cell culture, but we can do serological techniques too, one for the antibody, which is easy to do. There are some antiviral medications. Acyclovir is one of these. It reduces the severity and shortens the course of the outbreak, but it is not a cure. And they usually have to take this medication is a daily suppressive therapy. So this is medication that they take daily for the rest of their life. So once you get herpes, you've always got herpes. And this is not the only medication. There are some others that can be used as well.
I've never really understood why herpes virus can stay with you like for the rest of your life. But I mean, like, we get other kinds of viruses all the time.
It's a peculiarity of this family of viruses because it harbors itself in the peripheral nerves. And it can remain dormant in the nerves. And then something stresses it. Oftentimes with a cold sore, when a person gets an outbreak there, it's from sunlight, ultraviolet rays, stress, are often the triggers. Imagine the triggers for genital ulcers might be something different. Maybe stress would be the same thing. I doubt it's sunlight, but... Okay. Granuloma inguinale. Okay, this one's known as donovanosis. The organism is Calamatobacterium granulomatous. If I've never heard of that one, it's rare in the U.S., but this one is peculiar because of multiple sharp nodules on the skin. These ulcers and large colise means they kind of form together, form a larger ulcer, and then they form this beefy red tissue. It's untreated, it leads to extensive destruction of the genital organs. Granulomatous tissue.
So,
fortunately, it is rare in the U.S. Okay, what we can do in the laboratory is we'll take some of that tissue, stain it with a Giemsa stain or a Wright stain. Usually we don't do a Gram stain. And we look for these Donovan bodies, which are described as clusters of dark staining coccobacilli with a safety pin appearance. I don't know if you can see that, but they're kind of darker on each end. This one right here, you can see. And it's kind of clear in the center. Looks like a safety pin. So those are Donovan bodies. And these are in the cytoplasm of macrophages. So they have been phagocytized. You can see it in the cytoplasm. This is a Giemsa or a Wright stain. It's not a Gram stain. Okay. HPV, human papillomavirus, genital warts. Heard about that one. The warts can coalesce. They can be larger. They can be smaller. The problem with this one is strong association with genital neoplasia. In other words, it can cause cancer, cervical cancer from the HPV infection.
They have a vaccine for it.
Yes, yeah, they do have a vaccine for it. There's some controversy over the vaccine. Well, particularly the controversy is because whether you give it to 15-year-olds or not. You know, whether are you encouraging sexual activity by giving them this virus or this vaccine at that age. But you have to have two injections. And it's not without, the vaccine itself can have some symptoms. Lice, just small ulcerations. Usually they don't cause much problem. These little things, you know, you just very spooky looking things. Again, they're not that big. But they cause these little excoriations, like you scratch them, you get secondary bacterial infections.
So wait, that's a bacteria, or is that a...
No.
No,
it's the lice. No, that's the lice.
Okay.
The lice that get in there. And these can be sexually transmitted, but oftentimes they're not. They're associated with crowding or poor sanitation or whatever. And the last one is scabies, caused by some puppy scabii, which again is another little organism that burrows underneath the skin. It's in there, and that causes itching and excoriations, the redness and the red papules. So that can be transmitted sexually, but doesn't need to be. Okay, we're done. Oh, there's scabies. Remember the review tomorrow.